Thank you, Mark. It's such a pleasure to be back in Ogden again. I did my residency training here in 1981 to 1984, and then practiced here for a number of years after that before we moved to Colorado. So it's fun to be back here and see so many familiar faces, though all of us look a little bit older, but it's nice being here in Ogden. I'm going to take you to a completely different place than all the rest of the talks that you've heard so far today, so be prepared. I'm used to getting kind of a cold response from audiences sometimes because I'm the person who talks about death and dying, and it's the subject that people are not very comfortable with. But I hope by the end of this conversation you will be more comfortable, because that's my goal, is to encourage all of us to think and talk a little bit differently about death and dying. Let's see if I can figure out. I'm trying to figure out how to change the slides. Oh, the big one, okay. I have no conflict of interest. And my objectives are that at the end of this talk, you'll recognize the significance of the end of life as the final stage in human development, understand the opportunity for healing and transformation that exists at the end of life, and explain why spirituality is an important aspect of health during all stages of life, if we have time to get through all of that. So who am I, and why do I talk about spirituality and medicine and the end of life? Because I'm primarily a family practice physician. I did my residency here. But I got involved in hospice when, about 5 years after I finished residency, my own father died. He actually committed suicide. But I had a really difficult time dealing with grief and understanding death and accepting his death. And I decided eventually to become a volunteer for hospice to try to learn what I could learn about death and dying to help me with my own grief. And hospice medicine changed my life. It taught me so much. And I've been passionate about it ever since, and I've continued doing hospice and family practice either back and forth or at the same time through the rest of my career. I also have a love of storytelling and writing, and hospice provided me with these amazing stories of patients and their lives and their families, and that's what led to this book, What Really Matters. I was able to bring together my medical training, my hospice experience, my own grief experience, and then these stories of patients, and put those together. So when I talk now, I tell stories for the most part, so it's a completely different lecture than some of the others that you will be hearing during this conference, and there's not really anything to take notes on, but I'm here to touch your hearts. So I do that with my stories, and then also with some artwork that I've included in my slides. They come from an artist named Robert Pope, and there's a book of his work called Illness and Healing, Images of Cancer. And Robert Pope was an artist who was diagnosed with Hodgkin's at age 25. And he was lucky enough to have a 5-year remission in the midst of a 10-year illness, 10 years before he died. He had a 5-year remission. He did all of these paintings about from his perspective of what it was like to be a patient with a terminal illness. And they were so profound and so inspiring to me that I decided I need to use these in my talk. Because each picture tells a story as well. And if I don't, because it's such a short talk, I won't have time to point out a lot about his paintings, but he uses themes of light and dark to represent life versus death. And he has windows in many of his paintings. And most of these paintings are life-size paintings, and he did probably 35 of them in 5 years, and they're huge, all on display in Canada. So anyway, I wanted you to know about Robert Pope. So I've decided to talk a little bit about what doctors need to learn about death and dying. A couple of months ago, I got a phone call from an OBGYN professor in Boston, a woman whose mother was dying in hospice, and she said, "I can't believe it. I've been a doctor for 20 years. I'm a faculty member and an educator, and I don't know anything about death and dying. I don't understand what's happening. I'm in no way prepared for what's happening with my mom." And that reinforced to me how much we as doctors in particular need to understand the end of life, because our patients are going to be experiencing it. And that's my first point, which is death is inevitable. So ultimately, every patient, in spite of our best efforts, will die. And we have to come to terms with that, and we have to help our patients come to terms with that. Every living thing on our planet is going to die. And if our society could embrace that concept a little more readily, I think we would face it better, and we would do a better job of taking care of each other at the end of life. The second point is that death is a mystery. And I would bet every one of you has your own stories to tell of a patient who lived far longer than you expected them to live, and a patient who died when you were sure they wouldn't die. And even in hospice, where we imagine that we have some sense of the end of life, we know patients are terminal and have stopped treatment, we can't predict when death will come. And one patient came to us with end-stage colon cancer, and we thought he had about a six-month prognosis, and I visited with the patient and his family to tell them he would have about 6 months to live. And he died the next day of a massive MI. But another patient came to us with end-stage renal failure, and he, we assumed, would live about 2 weeks. He wasn't a candidate for dialysis. He lived for a year. And I'll tell you more about his story a little bit later on in the talk. So what I learned from hospice is that death is a mystery. We don't always know. We don't always know when or how it will come. And that's been a very important lesson for me to learn and think about for myself. The third point is that death makes life more precious. This is the primary lesson I learned from being around hospice patients who are facing a definite end and know this might be my last day, this might be my last week on earth. And when you're with them and you recognize that they are grasping everything they can and getting everything they can out of each moment of life that they have, precisely because they know it's coming to an end, it's really a beautiful gift to have that perspective. And it's kind of the hidden treasure of working with patients at the end of life, when it sounds like it would be so sad and so difficult. But in reality, these are people who are so fully alive and so fully engaged with life and loving every moment of it that it's infectious. And what transformed in my life for me was adopting that same attitude. You know I will die someday. I don't know when it will be. So I'm going to live like I'm at the end. I'm going to live with this same gusto and this same cherishing of how precious each moment is, and make the most of everything I have in my life. And the last point here is that dying, I learned through hospice, provides an opportunity for transformation. And I saw this over and over again with the patients that I worked with, and that's really the theme of the book that I wrote, What Really Matters, because I saw so many patients who changed, utterly changed, in the last few days of their lives. And this was one of Robert Pope's paintings of a woman, he said, that was in the hospital with him at the same time, and he said the closer she got to death, the more she seemed to glow, and she would light up the hallways when she would walk down the hall, and I thought that was a beautiful picture. So the transformations that I have seen patients make at the end of life have primarily been, I would call them, spiritual transformations, and love and forgiveness are two of the changes that I have seen patients wrestle with and make in their lives in the last few moments. And this was Robert Pope's depiction of love, of a couple spending their last moments together. The title for my book, What Really Matters, actually came from a patient that I worked with in hospice who was a very wealthy man. He owned a huge home, several cars, had spared no expense on many, many material possessions in his house, but he had no love in his life. And as he was on his deathbed, he said to me, "You know, love is the only thing that really matters. And I have all of this, and it's not important to me at all. It makes no difference to me." He said, I forsook love in order to have these possessions, but love is the thing that really matters. And he said, "I just figured it out, and I only have a couple of weeks left to live." The good news in his story is that we were able to connect with his son, who came to visit him before he died. So he had one chance to recapture some of the love that he hadn't had earlier in his life. But the next lesson that I saw pretty much every patient I worked with deal with is the idea of forgiveness at the end of life and needing to forgive other people and be forgiven by others. And we saw many, many powerful transformations take place in amongst our hospice patients and their families. We had one of our elderly female patients had three children, two daughters and a son. And the son had been estranged from the family for many, many years, hadn't spoken to anyone in the family. Because of something that happened, we never knew what it was, but there was hostility and anger in that family. The son hadn't been part of her life, and one of her greatest wishes was for her son to return and make amends with his sisters, for there to be a reconciliation with them. So we were able to convince the sisters to let us call their brother to come and visit their mom because it was so important to her. And the sisters wanted no part of their brother. They wouldn't stay in the house when he came to visit. They left, so he was there with her alone. And while he was visiting with their mom, he found out that not only her one greatest wish was for her children to reconcile, but she had a second great regret in her life, which was she'd been making this hooked rug for her latest great-grandchild. She'd made one for every grandchild and great-grandchild that had their name and birth date on it, and she was too ill to finish the rug. And she was very sad about that her last great-grandchild would not get this gift from her because she couldn't finish it. So her son left, the sisters returned later, still angry at their brother and upset that he had even been there to visit their mom. And about 3 days later, their brother came back to the house again and was carrying a shopping bag in his hand. The sisters decided to let him in and decided to stay because they were curious about what he was bringing in this shopping bag. So they were peeking around the corner, watching while he interacted with their mom. And he pulled out of the bag the hooked rug, which he had finished for their mother. And he was a big man with big gnarly hands, and he somehow figured out how to use this little latchet hook and pieces of yarn and finish that rug for his mother as a great gift for her before she died, so that she would know her great-grandchild would have the rug. And it was such a beautiful display of love and selflessness on his part. The two sisters, seeing that happen, forgave him instantly in that moment. And this 20 years of hostility and animosity were gone as this act of his, this selfless act, brought them all together. So that's one of just many, many experiences we saw with patients and these beautiful opportunities for them to heal their lives and heal difficulties that they had been dealing with for many, many years at the end of life. And these were the types of beautiful experiences that are possible for our patients. But in my mind, they need to have some time. They need to have the time and the opportunity in order to address these issues. So I do think it's important for us to be able to talk with patients realistically about how much time they have left or what the possible outcome is for them, to allow them time for these interactions to take place. And some other transformations that I saw taking place was just this idea of living fully in every moment, but also finding meaning and purpose in life. And this painting of Robert Pope's, he painted depicting when he was lying in the hospital bed with his Hodgkin's. He said the thing that gave him the most hope is that there was a horse chestnut tree growing outside the window, and he would see the leaves and the blossoms on that tree every day. And it, he said it let him know what life was really about, the beauty of seeing that tree outside the window. So he decided to paint a picture of that, of a patient looking at a tree. And it's interesting, I had found several months later after seeing this painting, I was reading Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, and he told a very similar story of a woman he was caring for in the concentration camp, and she was in the clinic dying. And she pointed to him, she pointed out the window to the very same type of tree, a horse chestnut tree that was growing outside the window, and she said, "Look, there is life." And she said, "I have hope because there is life growing even in the middle of a concentration camp." And so I found those two stories to be so profound and inspiring that each of our patients and each of us needs to find some sort of meaning in our lives. No matter what's happening to us medically, we need to find a way of making sense of what's happening in our life and finding meaning and purpose for our days here on earth. And I mentioned to you a patient earlier with renal failure who ended up surviving for a year when we thought he would die in 2 weeks. And this, he was one of my very favorite patients in hospice who was actually a vagrant. He'd lived most of his life down by the railroad tracks riding train cars around. He was a hobo, basically, and until he developed kidney cancer and then went into renal failure. He was able, through some stipend, to get this little apartment to live in, and as hospice workers, we came in to help take care of him at the end of his life. And I went to visit him there, and he had basically a mattress, a little table, and a chair in his apartment. That's all he had. And I sat on the mattress to talk to him while he sat in the chair. And in his dingy little apartment, I noticed these pieces of paper taped to the wall. They were like torn out of a spiral notebook and taped on all the walls. I went up to look at the papers, and they were drawings, pencil drawings, and they were beautiful. And I said, what are these? And he said, "Oh, I decided, since I don't have anything else to do now, to draw pictures of some of the things I've seen in my life when I've been riding on the trains." And he'd never drawn before in his life. He took it up just to pass the time while he was waiting to die, and discovered that he had this great artistic talent. His pictures were amazing, and there were mountain scenes and desert scenes and trains and rivers and wildlife that he was just sketching with a pencil. And so our staff was equally excited as I was that this man, who's, he's been homeless most of his life, has talent, and he never even knew it before until these last few days of his life. So the next day, someone dropped off some drawing pencils at his apartment, and then a sketch pad, and then some colored pencils, and we started providing him with some art supplies. And he started drawing every day and was spending every day, hours every day, drawing these amazing pictures. And suddenly, at some point, we realized, wait a second, it's been 2 months and he's still alive. And we thought he was going to die so quickly. And we redid his blood tests and found out his creatinine level had come down against all odds for no reason we could explain. But meanwhile, he was still loving doing his art. And it was really fun to watch him discovering this talent that he had and being able to utilize it in the last days of his life. And one day I went to visit him, and he showed me a page he'd torn out of a catalog, and it was a child's toy catalog, actually. But he had found a desk in this catalog that he was planning to order for himself as a drawing desk, because he wanted a little table to draw on, and it was called the student desk. And he was saving up money in order to order that student desk. And he did manage to order it from the catalog and was waiting and waiting for it to come. He was excited that he'd be able to have a special place for his drawing, to do his drawing. But one day I got a phone call from a neighbor of his from the apartment building asking me to come and check on Ralph. And he said, Ralph doesn't look good today. And I got there and Ralph was in bed in obvious pain and for the first time hadn't gotten up and gotten dressed. And I knew that Ralph was in trouble, but I also knew because he'd made the choice to be in hospice, he wouldn't go to a hospital, wouldn't go to an emergency room. He was choosing to live the rest of his life in that little apartment. And while I was there with him, the doorbell rang, and it was the postal man with a box, and it was the student desk that he had ordered. I was so excited and brought it in and said, look, Ralph, your desk came. Your student desk is here. And I was hoping that would inspire him, and I asked him if I could take it out of the box and put it together for him. But he said, no, leave the box. I just want to look at it for a while. And so I put the box next to his mattress so he could see it. And he then turned to me and said, you can go now. And he said, thanks for everything you've done for me, but I need to be alone for a while. And so I left, and by the next morning, his neighbor called and Ralph had passed away in the night and never got to open his student desk. But he was a patient that had endeared himself to every member of our staff, and in fact, we claimed his ashes after his death and had our own little memorial service for him because we became his family. But my point for this story is just the fact that even a patient who has led a very destitute life has meaning and purpose for their lives, and it's possible for patients to discover things about themselves even in the last days of their lives. That's one of the things hospice helps people with and enables them to find in life. And so the final point that I wanted to talk about is that it ends up coming down in my mind to including some spirituality in how we approach our patients. And the point is how we define spirituality and what spiritual care is for patients. And Paul Tillich, who is a theologian, said that spirituality is really one's ultimate concern in life. And what that means is then your spirituality is personal, and it's comprised of whatever really matters to you. So everyone is spiritual because everyone has some sort of ultimate concern. And for some of our patients, the ultimate concern is a religion, but for some, it might be baseball. And we had a hospice patient whose greatest love in life was baseball, the Chicago Cubs baseball. In fact, he loved that team. And when our staff would go to call on him, the only thing he would talk about was baseball, which was frustrating for the staff because they wanted to cover all these other issues with him, but he would only talk about games he'd been to and his love for the Chicago Cubs. So then we finally realized, well, baseball is his ultimate concern. Baseball is what he loves. We have to go with that. That's what he cares about in life. So when I went to visit him, I just decided to sit and listen to his baseball stories, and he showed me all of his autographed baseballs and his caps and photographs, told me all the games he'd attended, and I listened and listened and listened. And finally, when he got to the very end of all of his stories, he got tears in his eyes and then revealed, you know, he said, I have a wife and son that I left a long time ago. And he said, my greatest regret is that I never took my son to a baseball game. So by being able to be there for the patient and listening to his ultimate concern and accepting it as this is what matters to him, baseball, so we're going to listen to it and we're going to honor that for him, we were able to get to the underlying issue for him that he really needed to resolve, which was his own regrets that he hadn't been there for his son. So the question to consider is, why should doctors address the spiritual needs of patients? And I borrowed this from Robert Pope again, who said himself, illness is a spiritual experience. And he likened laying on the radiation table to being laid out on an altar. But illness ultimately breaks down the ego defenses. It strips away our pretenses. It confronts us with the unknown, creates a crisis of meaning. But it allows this opportunity for transformation that I've been talking about. And medicine and our scientific focus sometimes lose a sight of the inner needs of the patient. And it's not so much that it's our job to attend to those inner needs, but those needs are real and they're very big for most of our patients at the same time. And Pope depicts this woman in the hospital room looking out the window at a church with a steeple in the distance. Medicine sometimes creates a battle scene in which the patient is at war with his or her own body, mind, and spirit. And medicine has difficulty helping the patient make sense of tragedy and loss. And so that idea of finding meaning and purpose, sometimes the science of medicine falls short of helping people in those areas. And that's something I think that we as doctors could make up the difference if we were able to tune in and listen to the ultimate concern of our patients. We'd be able to help them a little bit when they do encounter these difficult times. So to best help our patients with their spiritual needs, we need to probably do what we're already doing, just treating their spirit, their physical suffering, and being mindful of their emotional and spiritual suffering as well. We need to treat each patient with compassion and dignity. We need to be fully present when we're with them and listen to their stories, even if they're about baseball or whatever their stories, to the best of our ability, to give them our time to listen and help them discover their own truth without imposing our own truths. And then being resourceful and creative in the moment, because sometimes and probably each one of you has done it. You've probably ended up saying just the right thing to a patient and you're not even sure why you ended up saying it, because it just comes to you in the moment. And that's the kind of creativity that our patients need from us. Ultimately, we are healers of our patients, whether we heal their physical bodies or help heal them emotionally and spiritually as well. And we physicians can be agents of change for our patients, for our society, and for our entire planet if we honor the sacred process of illness, healing, and death, and if we help our patients see the opportunities that lie within their difficulties. And so that's what I'm hoping you will feel inspired to do. And I want to just thank you for listening to the stories I came to share, for putting up with me and my very different type of talk. And I'm doing a book signing out front after this, if anyone's interested in my book. And I'll be here for the entire conference. I'd love to talk to some people I haven't connected with for a long, long time. But does anyone have any questions? Greg, so. It's hard for me to answer if hospice could go in that direction of euthanasia in the future, but I understand that concern that you have. By treating pain, that we are we hastening death when we're giving patients such high doses of pain medication? Morphine, yeah. It's interesting because my own mom just died in January, and she had no medications. And I got to observe her without morphine and without medications. I took care of her. And to observe her going through the very same process and sleeping all day, the same stages without morphine, which told me that I'm not sure the morphine causes all of it, actually, because I saw her pretty rapidly progress through the very same stages. And I always had the sense that morphine gives patients the opportunity to slip away when they're ready, like it puts them in such a relaxed state that it gives them the opportunity. But I saw plenty of patients also wake up who were on morphine, who needed to talk to someone or say something to someone. So, as far as euthanasia, I don't know. I feel like for the most part we were able to help patients who were suffering and end their physical suffering, which is absolutely our obligation. But I saw so many people have really meaningful experiences in their last days. I wouldn't want to deprive anyone of that time. I would want everyone to have as much time as they could have in those last days because it's so beautiful and special.
Karen, thank you for your thoughts. I also have enjoyed working with hospice the last several years of my practice. And my concern, and I'm sure yours as well, is so many physicians wait so long to refer their patients to hospice. What you've told us today is the opportunities are there if the whole hospice team has an opportunity to work with the patients, work with the families, to help them through this process of dying and all the adjustments that need to be made. Too often we're referred a patient who might have 1 day or 2 days to live, and it's clearly hard to do much in that situation. So I wonder if you might make a comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been one of the issues that's been studied a lot recently, is that some doctors are not, including oncologists working with terminal cancer patients, are not bringing up end-of-life issues until the last 2 weeks of life. And patients and their families are scrambling, trying to make a decision about what they want to do at the end of life when they've waited and waited and waited to the very last minute. And there isn't time under those circumstances to make good choices and plan ahead. And so the sooner we begin to talk to our patients about, even matter-of-factly, you know what, like, all of us are going to die. So have you ever thought about it? Do you have an advance directive or a living will? Have you ever thought about that? Because every one of us will die. It's a good thing to just be prepared for and think about, to mention that to our older patients, especially us baby boomers, because there's going to be a big surge of us at the end of life. And so I think it's possible to do it, even though we're working passionately to prolong people's lives and save their lives. I think it's possible at the same time to say, you know what, every life comes to an end eventually, so we all do need to think about it and be prepared for that time.
There it is. As a person and a profession, you came kind of to this knowledge that's been around for at least 10,000, if not a million years, a little bit late, in the sense that it's not part of your training, it seemed. Do you think there's something in us physicians as persons or as a profession that prevents us from realizing this stuff that's been talked around in the United States since the 1960s and in the world for millions of years?
Well, I've thought about that a lot and wondered if, I mean, I think it's normal in our whole society, all of us have a tendency to avoid the subject of death and dying and have discomfort with it. And we have reason to believe we're sort of the instant gratification society, where you can get anything you need pretty rapidly, and we have a false sense that we have control over things, and death is ultimately the one thing we do not have control over. It's difficult for us to accept that. But I have a concern within medicine that medicine hasn't quite done enough to embrace death and dying. And part of our oath even is that And we take our, that our job is to help people live and to save lives. And it's hard to reconcile that. If I'm here to save a life, how do I accept that my patient will die and let them know that they'll die? But I definitely think medicine needs to do a better job of preparing students. And the woman faculty member who called me and said, I don't know anything. I know nothing about death and dying. And she said, this isn't right. We should be the people who know about it. We should be the people in our society who are the best trained, who know the most about death and dying, not the ones who are clueless and have no idea what to do or how to respond. So I think it's an important step we need to take in medicine to help prepare doctors better coming out into practice. I think a lot of us end up dealing with death and dying, whether we were prepared for it or not. It happens, and so we end up dealing with it in our lives the older we get. But I'm not sure if that answers your question, but it's a societal problem, but it's definitely something we could improve by changing the way we educate doctors. Yes?
I think this ties in well with the two previous questions, but I'm a hospice volunteer here in Ogden, and I often find that family members are upset that the hospice patient has given up on life. I'm wondering how you personally deal with that.
Well, that was something I dealt with right away in hospice, that, and I actually had a fear about that in the beginning, was does it mean if patients decide to go to hospice that they don't care about being alive anymore and they're just giving up? But as I was saying, I found that actually many of those people loved life even more and got even more enjoyment out of life in their last days because of their decision to focus instead of on treatment, to focus on these moments with family and friends and enjoying everything they had left in life. So I started using those stories of patients to talk with families and encourage them that sometimes patients live longer in hospice than they live without hospice care. And sometimes patients find much more quality of life in their last days when they're in hospice. So for me, being able to tell stories of other patients has been the most helpful way to encourage family members to accept the idea of hospice. Okay.
What is your take now on the reality of one in the end stages of life having choice as to when to let go into death, or vice versa, or not to do so at a given moment in time?
I'm not sure if you're talking about, say, suicide?
No. No. We hear the refrain, well, so-and-so accomplished this or saw the person they wanted to see, they're satisfied, so they just decided to let go and die at that moment. Do you see choice? Do you see choice in that in an individual to slip to the other side, or say, for whatever reason, some child is traveling to see them or a relative or whatever or circumstance, they can also choose at that end stage, that very end stage, that they have choice to hold on a while longer? Or do you have ideas about that? And if so, have they changed?
Yes, I've definitely seen through hospice, as I mentioned, the idea of death being a mystery, because I've seen patients that we expected to die in within a day or two who actually lived for 2 weeks for that very reason. They were waiting for someone to come to visit them. And we knew it, even though the patient wasn't speaking to us and was in the active dying stage, so in a coma, we sensed that the person was waiting, and finally when a loved one finally arrived and got there 2 weeks later, the person died within that same day after being able to say goodbye. But I had another woman who, she refused pain medication. She didn't want to take anything for her pain at all because she was a person who meditated and had higher consciousness, and she felt that pain medication would interfere with her consciousness. And I said, but what are you going to do if the pain gets so severe at the very end? How are you going to cope with that? And she said, if the pain gets that bad, then I will know that it's time. It's time to go. And then I'll go. And I didn't really believe that was possible, but it is what happened when her pain got intense because she had bone metastases. She just called her family together and said, now the pain's here, and now I've decided that my time is up. And she said goodbye. It took about 3 days. She went into a coma, and within 3 days, she was gone. But it felt very much to me that she'd already planned it and knew it would happen. And that, again, was without drugs. There were no drugs that were causing her to enter into that state. It was a choice.
You see so many families state that to their loved one or friend, you can go now. You know, this is a common refrain. Mother, you can go now. You don't have to linger on. And then there's the semblance of, anecdotally in a way, that then they just expire. So the issue of will, you believe that there is an issue of control and to some extent at that end stage?
It's hard for me to say it in that, in the case of that patient I described, it appeared to be that there was some control. And with my own mother, I know she was waiting for my brother to tell her that he would be okay if she died, because they had never had a talk about her dying. And she felt that he was afraid for her to die. And she actually needed him to call her and say, Mom, it's all right with me if you go. I'm going to miss you, but if you go, it will be all right with me. And she died 36 hours later, but she was clearly waiting for that to happen. And she actually verbalized it to me, though, that I can't go until I know he will be okay. And so it's very fascinating what you can see when you start studying these people at the end of life. Any other questions? Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here.